This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today, an episode from the occasional series we're calling Vermont Edition Presents, where you get a seat at the table for some of Vermont's most interesting talks, lectures, and public events. The series features a wide variety of thought from guest speakers around our region, and it's our hope that you'll hear viewpoints that may add nuance or challenge your thinking on important issues. Today, the first of a pair of conversations that look at the future of the Republican and Democratic parties. This is from a talk recorded October 17th at Middlebury College called Conservatism After Trump, Populism Forever or Reaganism Restored. Our speaker is Ross Douthat, who joined the New York Times editorial page in 2009 as their youngest columnist. Before joining the Times, he was a senior editor for The Atlantic and a former lecturer at Yale Law School. Douthat is also the author of 5 books and a regular guest for television news programs. This is Ross Douthat, recorded live at Middlebury College. He starts by explaining the role of American exceptionalism as fundamental to the conservative worldview.
One way to think about American exceptionalism is not in terms of some sort of chest-thumping, America is the most awesome country in the world and every other country is infinitely less awesome, but in a slightly more subtle key, as basically the idea that America, like any society, has certain exceptional qualities, and those exceptional qualities have sustained our society and enabled our republic to flourish in various ways across its 200 plus years of existence, and therefore allowing for the necessity of reform and change, they are qualities that are worth defending and trying to preserve and help flourish in changing times. And so that, you know, every definition of conservatism runs into a little trouble around the edges, but I think it's useful to think of most conservatisms that way, not only American conservatism, that they tend to identify some particular feature of their society or particular features of their society that they see as enduring, long-standing, valuable, and under threat. And then they array themselves in defense of those exceptional qualities. So what does this mean in American politics? What does it mean for what we think of as the modern conservative movement, the movement that basically came into being somewhere between World War II and the founding of National Review magazine? A lot of outside observers of American conservatism have said to themselves, look, there's a lot of factions and groups within this big tent of American conservatism that don't really make sense together. Why are the libertarians who read Ayn Rand and fantasize about building the best skyscraper in the world and then blowing it up if necessary, if the government won't let them make it perfect, why are those people in the same coalition as evangelical conservatives, as Christian conservatives, as, you know, religious fundamentalists and so on? What do they have in common? And I think different understandings of American exceptionalism help explain those commonalities. So basically, what are some American distinctives? I think if you go back to, let's say, Alexis de Tocqueville, the Frenchman who took his famous journey through the United States in the early 19th century and tried to sketch out a sort of early account of American exceptionalism, you can see a lot of forces and patterns of life, patterns of being that have persisted down to the present day, or arguably persisted down to the present day. So America is distinctive in its religiosity, in the importance and centrality of religious practice and belief. Tocqueville comes to the U.S. from Western Europe, from countries that have established churches and, you know, no establishment clause, no separation of church and state, and he's surprised by just how pious and zealous and religious the United States is. And he sees it as a country filled with competing religious bodies, competing denominations and sects and churches. And out of this competition comes a flourishing religious marketplace in which specific churches rise and fall, specific religious movements rise and fall, but a persistent religiosity, stronger even than in a Catholic France or a Lutheran Sweden or an Anglican United Kingdom, is an enduring feature of American life that shapes all of our national debates, shapes debates over slavery, shapes debates over the Industrial Revolution and social reform, shapes debates over prohibition, shapes the civil rights era, and so forth. So religiosity. Then a commercial culture, right? The United States isn't just a a nation in which people practice commerce. It's a nation in which a culture of sort of a commercial spirit, sometimes shading into a spirit, let's say, of a little bit of con artistry and, you know, sort of the kind of Theranos-style hucksterism that crops up from time to time in American economic life. But that, too, has been a feature of American life going back to the beginning, that we are a nation that is not just a republic but a commercial republic that pays a special attention to the idea that getting rich and being entrepreneurial and building a business is an admirable aspect of human life and human affairs. And, you know, there are particular eras in our history when inventors and entrepreneurs and businessmen become much more famous than politicians and statesmen and religious leaders. And that, too, is, you know, it's not unique to the United States, but it is an American distinctive relative to other cultures and countries around the world. So you have religion, you have commerce, and then you have a suspicion of centralized authority and power that is connected to the first two. It's connected to the sort of heritage of nonconformist Protestant sects that were suspicious of established churches. It's connected to the businessman's skepticism of the tax collector. But it exists in American life and American culture as a political force unto itself that, again, is stronger than similar forces in Western Europe. There's more suspicion of centralized power, more suspicion of government, more suspicion of the state woven into American life than there is to a lot of other developed countries around the world. And then connected to that and connected back to religion, too, there's a strong communitarianism in which local voluntary associations, this is, again, something that Tocqueville remarked on, fill a lot of the space that in other countries and cultures are filled by state power. So it's not just the strength of churches and religious associations, it's the strength of fraternal organizations and charitable leagues and all of this sort of dense web of voluntary association that was striking in early 19th century America and remains striking in 20th century America as well, and that seems, again, in many ways, exceptional. And then, and this last is something that Tocqueville didn't really write about as much because the U.S. didn't have a sort of global foreign policy in the way that it has today, but coming out of Puritan ideas about their role in history through the era of Manifest Destiny down through the Cold War era, you have an idea in American foreign policy of sort of idealistic, transformational, a mission of liberty, basically, in the world, which takes different forms in different times. Sometimes it's more imperialist, sometimes less so. Sometimes it's a little more inward-looking, where you have the idea that we're just building a city on a hill here as an example for the rest of the world. Sometimes it's more outward-looking, and you get everything from Woodrow Wilson down to George W. Bush, sort of ideas of taking the torch of liberty out into the world and using the force of arms to spread democracy. So it has different forms, but there's a persistent sense that America has some sort of special mission. And again, because of America's deeply religious character, this mission gets framed often in religious terms, and it links the idea of the spread of democracy to God's providential work on earth. And so those are, I would say, the elements of American exceptionalism that in its own self-conception, and obviously this self-conception didn't always match reality, but its own self-conception, modern American conservatism evolved to defend. It saw itself defending American religiosity against the increasing secularism of American elites. It saw itself defending the tradition of American commercial capitalism against, at its inception, the threat of Soviet communism, but also the general rise of sort of command and control economics across the world in the early 20th century. It saw itself defending local self-government and local power against the centralized state, often to a fault, as in its resistance to the civil rights movement, but it saw itself doing that in reaction to the centralizing waves that came through American politics, first in the Progressive Era, then in the New Deal, and then in the Great Society, in which more and more money and power was concentrated in Washington, D.C. It saw itself defending, relatedly, the sort of voluntaristic and associational tradition in American life against the tendency of this increasingly powerful state and bureaucracy to colonize those spaces and effectively replace voluntary organizations, voluntary communities with sort of bureaucratic, top-down, and centralized ones. And then it saw itself defending a distinctive American mission in the world against, at its inception, again, the threat of communism, the danger of a different missionary power, the Soviet Union, with a different vision for remaking the world that was in tension with the idea of an empire of liberty and freedom and capitalist democracy. And that combination explains, to go back to what I said earlier, why you had sometimes strange bedfellows in the conservative coalition, why you had groups that, you know, in their sort of heart of hearts didn't necessarily agree about the meaning of life and the nature of the world and so on. It explained why you could have a libertarian wing and a socially conservative wing that in certain ways seemed very different. And it's because those tensions existed within American exceptionalism itself, right? I mean, America is a intensely libertarian and individualist country in certain ways, an intensely religious country in others, and so it makes sense that a coalition dedicated to defending those distinctives would end up with libertarians, Ayn Rand readers, as well as biblical literalists on the other side, even though those two groups culturally didn't necessarily have that much in common. And likewise with, you know, the world of foreign policy hawks, often seem to have little in common with other pieces of the conservative coalition. But what they did clearly have in common was they represented some distinctive strand of American exceptionalism that made sense to belong to a coalition dedicated to that exceptionalism's defense. So that is, I think, the story. It wasn't framed exactly this way, but I think that's basically the story of what American conservatism is, that you would inherit if you entered conservative institutions and the world of conservative ideas in the aftermath of the end of the Cold War, in the period when I was a college student, let's say, in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And you had this story that was told at that time by conservatives that was, you know, reasonably triumphant, that basically said, you know, look, the conservative movement came together to defend American exceptionalism, and overall it seemed to have succeeded. America won the Cold War. The Soviet form of communism, at least, passed into history. The expansion of government crested with the Great Society, crested in the late 60s and early 70s, and then receded a bit across Ronald Reagan's presidency. You had a wave of secularization in American life in the 1960s and 1970s, but by the 1990s, it seemed to have reached its limit, and there was at least a modest religious revival. And, you know, by the year of our Lord, 1999, the American economy seemed to be humming on all cylinders, and global capitalism, with the stewardship of Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan, seemed destined to carry us happily into some form of utopia. That's an exaggeration, but I'm trying to give you the flavor of how at least some people inside conservatism looked at the world at the time when I was, for better or worse, becoming a conservative. That was almost 20 years ago now. And I would say that the last 20 years have not been kind to both that triumphal narrative, but more specifically to the things that conservatives imagine themselves defending, right? So you can start with religion. If there was a modest religious revival between the 1970s and 1990s, it didn't fully counteract the big secularizing turn in the 60s and 70s. And over the last 15 or 20 years, any modest revival has gone into reverse. There's been a swift rise of Americans who have described themselves as having no religious affiliation. There's secularizing forces at work in both political coalitions. They're particularly stark in the Democratic Party. So America is less exceptionally religious, maybe even a little more European in its quasi-secularism than it was 20 years ago. It is less sort of communitarian and voluntaristic. The religious decline, again, is part of this, but you can see the larger, you can see the trends if you look beyond church going. The trends that Robert Putnam famously identified in his book Bowling Alone have continued apace. They may have been somewhat accelerated by the internet, which has created forms of community that are virtual and seemingly less effective in delivering the goods of communal life, at least judged by measures showing rising depression, rising suicide rates, rising loneliness. There's a whole host of measures whereby the American social life looks worse off than it did 20 years ago, certainly 50 years ago. So America is less exceptional in its sort of communitarianism. American capitalism looks less exceptional than it did at the peak of the dot-com boom. We've happily lived through a relatively robust economic expansion over the last 10 years, but it's been a very slow expansion following a very deep fall-off in the Great Recession. Generally, if you go from the late 1990s to about 2016 or 2017, there's almost no growth in market income for the median American family. American household wealth is down from the 1980s and 1990s. Obviously, there's more stratification and inequality, which Americans don't mind if everyone seems to be doing well, but everyone hasn't seemed to be doing well. Over the last 20 years, the promised dividends of our free trade deals with China did not materialize for many Americans, especially in working class communities. And out of all of this, there has been a turn among the younger generation towards a deeper skepticism of capitalism itself, which that indicator alone tells you that the culture, the sort of culture of capitalism, its hold over the American imagination and the American spirit is weaker than in the past. And you have a rival now in China itself that is not quite an ideological rival in the way that the Soviet Union was, but suddenly seems to many people to be more stable in its authoritarianism, its sort of mix of Maoism, meritocracy, and state-controlled capitalism than people confidently expected 10 or 15 years ago, back when, again, free trade and the internet were supposed to dissolve Chinese communism as surely as other forces dissolved Soviet communism. So the view, the sort of confidence in sort of democratic capitalism is at a much lower ebb. And then there's American foreign policy, which has not exactly been a run of amazing successes over the last 20 years. And in fact, it has featured a number of basically debacles, the worst ones under George W. Bush, but some under Barack Obama as well, perhaps a mild one ongoing at the moment in Syria under Donald Trump, but all of which have involved sort of the limits of a kind of missionary Americanism, the limits of fighting wars to spread democracy, the limits of regime change as a means to liberalize the world. And so out of that, there's a skepticism of that mission, a skepticism of America's capacities to change the world for the better, and a sense that America has, in effect, been taken advantage of, that the kind of Pax Americana that we have built costs too much in our own blood and treasure, and the world doesn't want it, and why should we be sustaining it anymore? And then out of all this, too, out of the skepticism of capitalism and so on, there's a there's a skepticism of the idea that was very popular not only among conservatives in the 1990s, that the era of big government is over, and if you just get government out of the way, communities will flourish again and markets will work. That idea has fallen out of fashion, or at least had its hold on the American imagination weaken, and the rise of both socialism and populism reflect that fact. So that is a somewhat abstract story of what movement conservatism imagined itself to be doing and why it's become harder and harder for the conservative movement to imagine itself doing that anymore and to make a case to the American people, who are mostly not fully committed to this particular vision of American exceptionalism, that conservatism as a political ideology, conservatism as a political movement, is in effect delivering the goods. I think you can understand the rise of Donald Trump and his success in the Republican primary in 2016 and his success in effectively taking the Republican Party away for a time from both its politicians and its intellectuals, certainly its newspaper columnists, whose total impotence was amply exposed. But you can see Trump as someone who I don't think ever sat down and sort of mapped out a theory of the case. That's not really what Donald Trump does. But at some level, for reasons that go all the way deep in his own past in some cases, and for reasons of expediency or just instinct in others, I think he grasped this shift in a way that almost no other Republican politician did. And, you know, the title of my talk mentions Reaganism. If you look at the men and women, but especially the men running for president as normal Republican politicians in 2016, and before that in 2012, and before that in 2008, there was always a sense that, you know, what worked for Ronald Reagan in 1979 and 1980 was what would work again in 21st century America. And maybe you needed to tweak or update in various ways. Maybe with Marco Rubio, you needed to champion a little more vocational education. Maybe you needed to get, you know, criminal justice reform with Rand Paul, but basically the sort of the package that Reagan was offering, which was, you know, a response to the crises of the 1970s, was still the package that Republicans should be offering today. And Trump had no interest in any of that. And so you had the spectacle of him standing up on the debate stage and getting attacked by the end, usually by Ted Cruz over here and Marco Rubio over there, for saying things that were not conservative. And Trump didn't care that they were not conservative. If he standed up and said, we need a big, beautiful healthcare plan that takes care of everybody, and the people around him said, well, that sounds kind of like socialism. He said, well, whatever, I don't care. Or if he stood up and, you know, and said, what are we getting out of NATO? Why are we, you know, why did we go into Iraq? George W. Bush, he didn't keep us safe. He got us into a war and he presided over 9/11. And all around him, the Republicans on the stage would say, you know, well, you're a heretic. You're dangerous. That's ridiculous. That's absurd. And enough Republican voters didn't care about those orthodoxies, those ideas of what conservatism is, that Trump was able to not just sort of build a small base of support, which is what I think he did initially with his birtherism and sort of, you know, the stuff where he was sort of trying to build a core base of often very online and sometimes very extreme support, but a bigger base. He built a bigger base very quickly. It was about 25% to 30% of the Republican primary electorate. And to those voters, and they were often voters who had not made out well in the last 20 years. They were more likely to be working class, more likely to be in communities that had lost jobs to China, more likely to be in communities that had sent sons and daughters overseas to die in the Iraq War. To those voters, the defense of American exceptionalism that in different ways a Rubio or a Cruz or even a Rand Paul were offering just didn't speak to their lived experience. From their perspective, that exceptionalism maybe existed once upon a time, but now it had gone away. And the question was no longer how do you defend these aspects of America? It was much more, how do you survive in an American culture that suddenly seems hostile to you? This gets, I think, to one useful way of understanding what's happened on the American right, and not just the American right, also other rights over the last 5 or 10 years, which is there's conservatism and then there's reaction, right? And sometimes these terms get conflated and there's no perfect way of dividing them. But one way of thinking about it is that a conservative politics is a politics that feels confident in its ability to maintain important continuities through periods of dramatic change. And a reactionary politics is a politics that feels like the continuity is gone, the defeat has happened, and the question is, how do you get what you've lost back? And in the transition from a conservatism of American exceptionalism to a more populist conservatism, a more America-first conservatism, a conservatism that is more in favor of using government power for its own ends instead of just limiting government. In that transition, I think you can see a transition from a conservative era to a reactionary era. And again, I think you can see similar things in European politics and elsewhere around the globe, that is basically what a lot of conservative populism represents. And Donald Trump promised a lot of different and sometimes contradictory things in 2016, but I think that aspect of what he was promising was really important to a lot of his Republican voters, and then maybe especially to some of the voters who switched from Barack Obama in 2012 to voting for him in 2016. So that, I think, is the essence of the transition from Reaganism to populism, basically, that it's a transition from a view of American exceptionalism as something that exists and can be defended to a view of it as something that no longer exists or no longer exists to the same extent and needs to either be defended much more militantly, rebuilt with different uses of power, or something different needs to be built in its place. Now, I don't think that description of Trump's campaign really fits how Trump has actually governed, and I think it doesn't fit mostly because, again, I don't think Trump himself sort of fully thought this out. I think it was a much more sort of instinctive and sometimes accidental approach to politics that then when he came into Washington, D.C. and won an election that he obviously didn't expect to win, there was no architecture in place. You know, there were a bunch of vague promises like a big, beautiful healthcare deal and build the wall and make Mexico pay for it, that nobody was prepared to translate into policy. And Trump himself wasn't the kind of figure who was going to go out and find 16 interesting heterodox thinkers on the right and put them in charge of his administration. I think one of the reasons there was so much temporary fascination around Steve Bannon was that he was the one person in Trump's orbit who did seem to have thought some of this through, who had some idea, some of it quite dark, some of it more positive of what populism could be. But Bannon came in and basically tried to take over every aspect of the Trump administration, as far as I can tell, and now ended up running none of them. And once the brief Bannon era ended, then the Trump administration was basically just a collection of old guard Republican politicians and figures like Mick Mulvaney, who was on television today defending Trump, who I believe occupies at least 16 acting cabinet offices at the moment. That's a mild exaggeration, but Mulvaney, who was a Tea Party congressman, who was very much an old school Republican figure. And that's sort of true up and down and throughout the Trump administration. You can identify something that is Trumpism, but there aren't very many people in the Trump White House who are actually Trumpists, and even Trump himself isn't always that. So instead of some sort of coherent populist or reactionary agenda, whatever term you want to use, you've had first an attempt to sort of just replay the old Republican greatest hits, which was what happened as long as Paul Ryan was in charge in the House. So you're going to repeal Obamacare and pass a corporate tax cut, which were not really the things that Trump had run on, but they were the things that the Republican Party knew how to try to do. So they tried to do them successfully in the case of the tax cut, unsuccessfully in the case of health care. But then after that, you've basically had stalemate and gridlock and a bunch of, you know, forays using the power of the administrative state that get liberals very agitated, but I don't think represent any kind of capacious or sweeping agenda. And Trump himself has remained where he began, a fairly unpopular president who's never built his base of support beyond about 40 to 45% of the electorate. And so if you look at the Trump presidency right now, even pending the outcome of the whole impeachment business, you would have to say that his style of populism has been politically unsuccessful, that he has failed to build the kind of larger support that you would need for it. He's failed to sort of transform the upper echelons of the Republican Party in a way that, you know, brings people in line with whatever a populist agenda would be. And he's likely to lose re-election. And if he doesn't lose re-election, it's almost hard to imagine what will happen over the over the succeeding 4 years. But it's very unlikely to be any kind of sort of sustained agenda building of any sort. So in that sense, to, I guess, move towards ending with where with the question that opens the talk, there will be, I think, a lot of people in the Republican Party, let's assume for the sake of argument that Trump loses re-election, there will be a lot of people in the Republican Party who basically say, well, this was a weird accident that happened. We're not really sure how it happened. It was probably CNN's fault. But the, yeah, you have a lot of Republicans who will basically say, well, Trump, you know, he was a reality television star who won a primary in a divided field and happened to exploit some particular weaknesses that Hillary Clinton had and got himself elected president almost by a fluke. And now that he's gone, we can go back to the approach to conservatism, the idea of conservatism that we had before, and nominate, let's say, Nikki Haley for president in 2024, and just have a kind of Reaganite restoration, basically. And, you know, if you talk, let's say there are about 50 Republican senators, I would say probably, well, the 10 of them are completely checked out and don't have any thoughts about the future of their party. Another 35 would probably agree with this, what I've just said, and basically say, yeah, that's right. Everything's fine in the Republican Party except Donald Trump, and once he's gone, everything will be fine again. And then there are maybe 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 who have a different idea and basically think that Trumpism happened because the old Republican agenda didn't work anymore and you need a new Republican agenda. And that group would include figures like Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, basically all the Republicans who want to run for president. And I think I think as you can probably tell from this talk, I think the latter group are right. I think there isn't any going back to Reaganism, because effectively the aspects of American society that Reaganism imagined itself defending really have weakened and diminished, sometimes because of forces beyond the Republican Party's control, sometimes because of mistakes the Republican Party itself made, disasters it wandered into, sometimes because of the limitations of the ideological world picture that this defense of American exceptionalism required. But for better or worse, the world of an America sort of defined by its religiosity, its communitarianism, its commitment to capitalism and commercial culture, its sort of confidence in a missionary role around the world, that world doesn't exist in anything like the same way it existed when Buckley founded National Review or when I came of age as a conservative. And so some version of populism and reaction in that climate is pretty much inevitable. And the big question, it doesn't mean it's inevitable in 2024, right? It doesn't mean that, you know, it's impossible that Nikki Haley could be nominated as a Reaganite, and it's not impossible that she could win. I mean, you know, any American politics at the electoral level is very contingent, and you don't want to draw sweeping conclusions from one primary campaign or one election. But if you look at where conservative politics is pretty much everywhere in the Western world right now, if you look at the likely arc of the next 15 or 20 years, you would have to say that the forces that gave us Donald Trump aren't going anywhere. And if that's the case, then really the big question is not the one that I framed this talk with. It's not Reaganism restored versus populism forever, because Reaganism isn't going to be restored in any recognizable form. The question is just what kind of populism are you going to have? And I think in certain ways the Trump administration has showed us not at all the worst case scenario, but one of the more unfortunate scenarios for what a populist future looks like, where there is sort of a patchwork of somewhat incoherent policy objectives that are united mostly by the desire to own or trigger the libs. And there is, in a more secular America, an increasing reliance on racial tribalism and white identity politics to bind the conservative coalition together. And I think that is basically the obvious danger for any kind of populism, but particularly a populism in a country like the United States with a long history of racial conflict and racial oppression, that basically you have, you know, if you end up with a coalition of liberals and the left that's defined by its multiculturalism, its multiracialism, and you end up with a conservative coalition that's defined by sort of organizing white grievance against that new landscape and that new America. And I don't think that's the only possible future. I think there's another possible future where you figure out a way to basically have a kind of conservative populism, a kind of conservative nationalism that is pan-ethnic and that is rooted in the weakened but still resilient religious aspects of conservatism, but that basically takes some of the ideas that shape the Trump campaign, ideas of, you know, sort of how do you figure out how to protect Americans buffeted by globalization? How do you put yourself on the side of a working class that, you know, exists in a state of neglect and decay, even as a sort of these sort of gilded cities rise on the coasts of your country and attract talent from everywhere and leave other parts of the country behind? How do you fight on behalf of those people without pitting people against each other along racial lines? And how exactly you do that is an open question and a big challenge. But I think that is the actual challenge that conservatism after Trump has to meet. It's a challenge that basically says, look, Trump and populism had a critique of conservatism, a critique of the limitations of the conservative agenda in the early 21st century. That critique was broadly right. The world of American exceptionalism that modern conservatism evolved to defend doesn't exist anymore, doesn't exist in the same way. You need a new approach, new agendas, new strategies, new visions. How do you make those visions be something more than just a defensive bulwark built up around 40 to 45% of the country who feel threatened by a new America? How do you make them a vision for 55 or 60% of the country that divides the country? All politics divides the country. The idea that a divisive politics, a polarizing politics is terrible is somewhat silly. Franklin Roosevelt divided the country. Ronald Reagan divided the country. The key is to divide the country and make sure that you have the much, much bigger half. And that sounds cynical, but it is actually the heart of idealism in certain ways, because an ideal politics is one that unifies the largest possible percentage of the country around an agenda rather than being purely defensive around a minority that's large enough to sort of hold on to power without knowing what to do with it. That's the pickle that conservatism is in right now. It is a minority worldview at the moment with an incoherent agenda and support from enough of the country to keep liberalism out of power, but not enough of the country to actually govern. And that could go on for a while, and it will be depressing if it does, but something better is also possible. And you'll note that I haven't given you any specifics of what that something better might be, but unfortunately my time is up, so thank you so much for listening.
It struck me as you were talking about religiosity that Gallup for several years in a row now has deemed Vermont the least religious state in America. There's a large spire right next to us, though. But Governor Weld was here. I think he was on the very spot where you're seated now. And he had an interesting thought that I'd welcome your reaction to about the future of the political alignment. He suggests something more drastic. We have a president now, the Republican nominee, who hasn't been a Republican very long. The fellow who almost won the Democratic nomination 3 years ago has never been a Democrat. And Governor Weld mentioned the different types of conservatives to which you alluded. And he said maybe this is 1850s again, when the Whigs were divided, the Democrats were, the Free Soilers came along, and a new party dedicated to abolishing slavery emerged and, of course, was the Republican Party. Is it possible we'd have a populist party, a socialist party, and a sort of centrist party going forward?
So one way to think about it, right, is that basically in 20th century American politics, it was very normal to have third-party candidates, not sort of sustained, persistent third parties, although, you know, there were occasionally, but not really. What was more normal was that you would have a particular figure who sort of embodied a tendency that was in certain ways extreme and in certain ways centrist. But those figures would sort of emerge, challenge the two-party system, and then the energy that they represented, the grievances that they channeled, would be the two parties would sort of compete and try and end up absorbing some of those grievances into their own agendas. And what's changed, I think, is that the institutional parties are just much weaker than they used to be. And so, therefore, it's easier for figures who in a different era would have been third-party candidates to sort of just enter the existing parties and take them over from within. And that's basically what Trump did.
Interesting. Let me ask you about our place in the world in a conservative environment. A lot of conservatives are isolationists, basically. They like tariffs. My personal local hero, Calvin Coolidge, imposed many of them. They want to get out of foreign wars. They don't want to get in them. How would a conservative look at America's role in the world in terms of global leadership while at the same time maintaining a strong economy and, to some degree, putting America first?
So, yeah, I mean, to your first point, in that sense, there are ways in which Trump is a late 19th century Republican. Tariffs, trade, and limited interventions overseas was a standard Republican Party vision for the first 70 years, 80, 90 years even of the party's history. So there is a sort of back to the future quality or I guess just back to the past. The movie's title is always so confusing to Trump on trade and intervention. I mean, I guess this is a case where I'll offer my own take, right, which is that Trump's instincts are basically a mix of isolationism and Jacksonianism and, you know, working with governments that he likes to make business deals with, right? Like, those are sort of the three elements of his foreign policy. The last Republican administration fought a very expensive and ultimately unsuccessful and very ambitious war to try and remake the Middle East. And then after that, there wasn't a strategic vision, right? Republicans after the failures in Iraq didn't have a strategic vision. They just had a list of places where they thought we should be more aggressive relative to Obama. So there is, I think, a zone in between isolationism and sort of Wilsonian idealism, which is basically a view that says the Pax Americana generally is a good thing. Our presence in lots of countries around the world isn't, as Trump says, just them ripping us off. It's actually a kind of worthwhile investment in global peace from which we all benefit. But we get in trouble when we get too ambitious and aggressive and, you know, imagine that we can use regime change and military force to dramatically remake the world, and we need to have priorities. And so, you know, something, the general vision, right, for all the sound and fury around Russia, the general vision that Trump had that we should be on better terms with Russia and work harder to contain China is totally non-crazy. It's hard to pull off because it's not clear that Putin's government wants better relations, but it's a totally reasonable basic vision. And some version of that that basically says, well, what are the priorities for the American military in 2020? How do we, you know, as we weaken somewhat relative to other powers, how do we maintain the good things about the Pax Americana? How do we avoid getting another Iraq or another Vietnam? Somewhere in there, I think, is a reasonable and sort of realist Republican foreign policy that could emerge out of the current tension between Trumpism and the older hawkish neoconservatism. That would be sort of, that would be the ideal scenario. I mean, I think up until I think the way Trump has handled what's going on in Syria has been totally feckless and disastrous. Up until that point, I have thought that Trump's foreign policy has been in many ways better than his domestic policy, and that out of this weird mix of old line Republican figures in his administration, he has sort of groped his way towards a somewhat reasonable approach to the world that is basically, you know, sort of taking threats like Russia and North Korea and saying these are not as big priorities as the threat from China, and we're going to basically pull back a little bit in a lot of places while ramping up some conflict with China in order to sort of reduce their influence, and hasn't always been handled well, but I think as a general strategic approach it's been reasonable. The next year or so may be different.
Well, you'll be writing about it.
Hopefully.
What a great discussion. And Ross, you've given us a lot to think about. We're honored to have you at Middlebury College. Let's thank our special guest. Thank you so much.
That was former Vermont Governor Jim Douglas with New York Times columnist Ross Douthat in a live event recorded at Middlebury College on October 17th. This has been Vermont Edition Presents, where we bring you interesting public talks and lectures from out in the community. Thank you to the Alexander Hamilton Forum at Middlebury for making this talk available to us. For more information about future forum events, you can follow them on Twitter at Hamilton Forum. Vermont Edition Presents is produced by Kari Anderson. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.